Right, so we come to the second look at Catherine Mansfield today. And in particular, I want to try and address the question which I suppose is at the heart of everything we're doing, really, is thinking about how these writers that we're looking at manifest their modernist credentials, if you like. So what is modernist about Catherine Mansfield? And I think as we go through the module, then what becomes clear is that what makes one person modernist is not necessarily what makes another person modernist. Modernism seems to be a very broad church. There seems to be all kinds of different ways in which you can express your modernity. And so we need to try and be specific about what makes our modernists modernist. Having said that, you know, there are some parallels that you can draw. I want to make some comparisons in this between Mansfield and Virginia Woolf. Virginia Woolf, who famously didn't like Catherine Mansfield that much, said she was rather smelly. This might be something to do with the fact that she had tuberculosis at the time. I want to say a little bit about her achievements as a modernist, I think. Try and say something about what's distinctive in her work. And conclude by sort of setting up our later sessions after this and on Friday, looking at those particular stories. So that when we've done that, we'll have looked at six stories and we'll have had a decent overview, I think, of Catherine Mansfield's career. Just going back to last week, we mentioned that Mansfield had a relationship to other modernist writers, that she was not a kind of fully paid up member of the Bloomsbury group, but certainly there on the periphery. She certainly interacted with other members of that group, Wolf, Murray, Strachey, other people like that. But that I suppose there's this sense always with Mansfield of her being somehow an outsider. Perhaps it's something to do with her background in New Zealand. But she never seemed to want to be a part of those groups particularly. Her work, of course, is distinctive in the sense that she concentrates almost exclusively on the short story, which none of the other modernist writers did. There's very little in the way of other work beyond the short story. So that makes her somewhat distinctive as well, I think. And we said about those short stories that they're fairly limited in their scope and in their setting, so that you've got that group of stories which is set in New Zealand, and you've got the group of stories which are set largely in London, and there's a few of the stories with the European setting, but they tend to focus on the same social strata, if you like, the kind of upper middle class strata that she came from herself in New Zealand. The emphasis on the commonplace, by which I mean it's quite usual in Catherine Mansfield's story for nothing of any great import to happen, that there might well be some event that has some impact on one or other of the characters. But often that takes place off stage. So if you think about Bliss, then there is a big moment, isn't there, at the end of Bliss where Bertha realises that her husband might be deceiving her, but we don't know what's going to go on after that. We can speculate. And I think the story gives us some ammunition for that speculation, gives us some ideas about what might happen. In The Daughters of the Late Colonel, which we'll look at later on today and this week, the event, if you like, is the death of the Colonel. But that's happened off stage, as it were, before the story starts. And what we're dealing with in The Daughters of the Late Colonel is the daughter's reaction to that event. So that's what I mean by the emphasis on the commonplace, that there is rarely some kind of earth-shattering event that's central to the story. There might be stuff going on in the background, in the periphery. It's always about the internal world of the characters, and this is, you know, a key modernist characteristic, isn't it? That our writers, as Virginia Woolf says in that famous passage, which I keep on repeating to you, that she wants to examine an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. She wants to examine what goes on in people's minds rather than to describe the external detail of their lives in the kind of traditional way. Catherine Mansfield definitely buys into that. And, you know, is often concerned with the thought processes of her characters. So therefore, the kind of plot that you might expect in a traditional short story doesn't seem to happen quite in the way that you might imagine. If you go back to those 19th century short stories with the sort of compressed novel type structure, where you've got an introduction, a development, and then some tying up of the ends. You're not getting that at all in Catherine Mansfield, nor are you getting it in the other short fiction by our modernist writers. Instead, what you've got is this observation of life, which is often to do with the idea of personality, character, and identity, I think. You know, if we... I'll mention this later on as well, but the Daughters of the Late Colonel, for example, one of the key issues, it seems to me, there is that the daughters are and have been all their life defined by the presence of the late colonel. And if you take that that presence out of their lives, then to some extent they cease to have their own identity. Okay, so... That's where we're going, I hope. I want to say a little bit about what Mansfield says about her own method of writing, and in particular thinking about this idea of the self. And I think this is a key idea in modernism, the idea of individual identity and how we present ourself, or as Mansfield would say, ourselves, to the world. And she talks about in her journal being preoccupied with what she calls the secret self that we all have. So in other words, we're not presenting to the world perhaps a straightforward, transparent version of ourselves. We're acting out something else. And it might be one other self, or it might be several of the selves. And this is what she seems to be reflecting on later on in her journal. She quotes that line of Polonius. Remember Polonius in Hamlet saying to... I've forgotten his name. What's his name? Polonius' son. Come on, you did Hamlet. What's Polonius' son called? Forgotten. Anyway, him, Polonius Jr., he's going off in the world, and Polonius says, "To thine own self be true," which has become a sort of cliche, hasn't it? One of those little mottos that people have. I suppose that most of the time now you see people tattoo it on their arm or something, don't they? "To thine own self be true." But she actually questions that in her journal. She says, true to oneself? Well, which self? And she begins to speculate on how that idea of the self might be construed. And she says, which of my many? Well, really, that's what it looks like, coming to hundreds of selves. So she talks about having multiple selves, multiple identities. And that will depend on the circumstances that she's in. Now, she's obviously talking about herself there. This is her journal. But presumably, that will then translate into her writing. And when she's thinking about characters in her story, she will talk about people having different selves. And we'll see this when we look at Prelude later on, that that is very much exemplified in that story. A couple of other things that I think are worth mentioning just to set the context of Mansfield's writing. Her journals, which are, you know, which are fascinating and worth having a read, she mentions in a couple of places being influenced by art, and in particular the post-impressionists. Now, of course, Wolff famously said, and it's usually associated, it's not actually absolutely certain that Wolff was referring to the post-impressionist exhibition of 1910, when she said, in December 1910, human nature changed, which is a rather pompous and portentous thing to say about an exhibition of art. And certainly Mansfield didn't say anything quite like that. But she went to that exhibition. This is the exhibition of organised by Roger Fry of European post-impressionists. So it's people like Gauguin, Van Gogh, and people like that. Which, of course, by 1910, these are already sort of 25, 30 years old, these paintings, but it's the first time that they've been exhibited in London, and they caused a sensation. Hence Wolff's comment, possibly. Mansfield but felt the same, and she felt that this influenced the way that she wrote. In other words, I think what both Wolff and Mansfield are getting at is that the impulse, the requirement in art to present something that is what we might think of as photographically realistic has gone. You know, that isn't the point anymore. And at its extreme, you get things like cubism and so on, which abandon all attempts at figurative pictorial form. But, you know, if you look at a Van Gogh or you look at a Gauguin, then you're looking at recognisable figures, recognisable shapes, landscapes, and so on and so forth. But expressed in a very different way. You know, the artist isn't trying to get that photographic realism. He's trying to get some sort of impression over. So that spills over into the writing of Mansfield, Wolff, and other modernist writers, I think. The abandonment of the requirement for it to be fantastically realistic. And that's what Wolff is going on about in modern fiction. A couple of other things that are worth mentioning in Mansfield's short stories, that they often focus on what some critics have called moments of disruption, when maybe two ideas collide. So a good example is the garden party, where you've got the settled upper middle class world of the garden party and the preparations for that. And then what disrupts that, what intervenes into that, is the death of the working man. And those two worlds then collide. Except that they don't really collide, because Laura's mother doesn't want them to collide. And, you know, we've just got the girl as the connection between the two. You might compare that with Joyce's idea of epiphanies, where a character comes to a realisation of something during the story as a result of what's happening in the story. And in the case of the garden party, of course, at the end, there is some sort of realisation, isn't there? But frustratingly, perhaps, we don't really know what it is because she can't articulate it at the end. And so the story finishes in a moment of inarticulacy. Life is what? You know, we don't know. She can't articulate it. And I suppose also we might think about these elements being what Wolff called moments of being. Moments of being is a title of a short story that remained uncollected in Wolff's lifetime, was published later on. But it's also a phrase that she used, and I think what is meant by that is a kind of intensifying of life, you know, a sudden realisation, a sudden insight that a character might have as a result of the circumstances they find themselves in. So those are the kinds of things, I think, that Mansfield is looking at. Okay, so if we think about this idea of cells, I thought this this line from Nancy Gray's article in a useful book called Catherine Mansfield and Literary Modernism is worth presenting to you and just unpicking a little bit. And you know, it's actually quite complicated because what Nancy Gray is doing there is quoting bits of Mansfield's writing and then sort of constructing her own argument around it. So you can see you've got the internal inverted commas in there as well. So Gray says, despite our, and this is Mansfield talking, persistent yet mysterious belief in a self which is continuous and permanent. Persistent yet mysterious belief in a self which is continuous and permanent. Well, that sounds very much like a sort of 19th century approach. It sounds to me like Thomas Hardy, actually. Hardy in Mayor of Casterbridge, Kim, says character is fate, I think. So suggesting that, you know, your character is a kind of fixed thing and it will eventually be your doom or your salvation or whatever. It will be your fate. Mansfield suggesting that might be our belief, but it's not that. What we get instead are, and what, this is what she says, and it's an interesting metaphor, I think, moments when I feel I am nothing but the small clerk of some hotel without a proprietor, who has all his work cut out to enter the names and hand the keys to the willful guests. So if we're thinking about that as a writer, then she seems to be suggesting that she hasn't really got much control over the characteristics of her characters, that she somehow has to present them, she's sort of dashing around trying to keep them under control. You know, she's got a work cut out, getting their names and handing their keys. You know, she can't do much more than that. She can't control them. And there seems to be a sense, I think, throughout Mansfield's writing, that people develop in unexpected ways. And this idea of multiple selves, of not having a fixed character, not a continuous and permanent character, that's abandoned in favour of something much more complex, much more fluid, and of course much more difficult to nail down, much more difficult to describe if you're the writer of the story. And we'll look at some examples of how this works in a minute. So I think what I'm suggesting then is that Mansfield's approach, Mansfield's technique, is one which relies on these very impressionistic presentations of people, that it doesn't rely on a particularly organised structure, it doesn't rely on set characteristics for her characters. It's much more fluid, much more complex, and therefore, I think, much more modernist. So I'm going to present you with a few thoughts now on those specific stories, which we'll follow up in our discussions later on. So are we okay so far? Yeah? Good? Right? Okay, so Prelude then, if we're thinking about that. Prelude, of course, is an interesting title for a start. You might discuss that when you sit down in class. Why is it called Prelude? The beginning of something, or beginning something of something greater, which is going to happen later on, maybe. But Kate Fulbrook, in her very good book, I think, about Catherine Mansfield, talks about this business of the difficulty of nailing characters down in terms of their characteristics. The characters are presented in terms of the intersection of light and shade, and seen fleetingly against the light of the stars and the evanescent mystery of the sea. Yes, there's quite a lot of symbolism in Prelude and in the other stories, and we'll mention that later on. But this idea then of characters presented in sort of metaphorical terms, you know, the intersection of light and shade, seen fleetingly against the light of the stars. You know, these are therefore not kind of solidly defined characters. These are not rounded characters with, you know, all of their attributes presented to us fully. These are actually rather more mysterious. And one of the things I think that you find in Catherine Mansfield quite often is that you get a surprise, don't you? That a character does something that you're perhaps not expecting. And that, I think, again, chimes in with that idea of multiple selves. So what it suggests is that identity is not something that's fixed, not something that you can suggest is permanent, but instead is something which is fluid and dependent on circumstances. And this is recognised in the quotation from Mansfield herself, which I gave you before, and in this quotation by Sidney Kaplan, which is from Catherine Mansfield on the Origins of Modernist Fiction, another very useful source. Mansfield's aesthetics are grounded in a recognition of the self as many selves. So that what she's Kaplan's suggesting, I think, is that the basic idea that Mansfield starts with when she's presenting character is that they are going to be multiple selves rather than one self. And we want to see how that's played out in some of the stories. So here, for example, is Beryl in Prelude. So in the Oxford edition, this is the bottom of page 117 on to page 118. And if you, you know, the various things have happened in the story, and Beryl is writing this letter about the events that have happened, but in doing so she becomes aware, not for the first time, that she's writing it kind of in character, that she becomes somebody else when she writes it. And Mansfield is very interesting here, because she goes into the typical free and direct discourse. We go into the mind of Beryl and we discover what she's thinking. So she's writing this letter, and then, of course, from In a Way, we're into Beryl's mind, aren't we? In a way, of course, it was all perfectly true, but in another way, it was all the greatest rubbish, and she didn't believe a word of it. No, that wasn't true. She felt all these things, but she didn't really feel them like that. And there's this, I think this is a very typical moment in Mansfield's writing, where characters try to refine their feelings. They try to grasp at exactly what it is they're thinking, and often fail. You know, she's trying to work out what it is she feels really, and she can't. Maybe because she's got these kind of multiple selves. So she says to herself, it was her other self who had written that letter. It not only bored, it rather disgusted her real self. And you can almost kind of feel the inverted commas around real, can't you? Flippant and silly, said her real self. Yet she knew that she'd send it, and she'd always write that kind of twaddle to Nan Pym. In fact, it was a very mild example of the kind of letter she generally wrote. And she, you know, what emerges from that final paragraph is the level of disgust that she has. Which manifests itself in all kinds of different ways, but she's disgusted with who she is, but she can't escape who she is. The voice of the letter seemed to come up to her from the page. It was faint already, like a voice heard over the telephone, high, gushing, with something bitter in the sound. Oh, she detested it today. She detested her voice, by extension, herself, doesn't she? And a bit later on in that story, I mean, this towards the end anyway, but even further towards the end, she says, I'm so miserable, I'm so frightfully miserable, I know that I'm silly and spiteful and vain. I'm always acting a part. I'm never my real self for a moment. So repeating that idea of the real self. But this idea then of presenting different versions of yourself is something which is obviously played out in Prelude, but also occurs, I think, in quite a few of the other stories. And it's a key feature, I think, of Mansfield's writing. So just saying a little bit more about Prelude. This idea of acting out roles and role-playing, as I suggested in that last quotation, seems to be an element which is present throughout. You could even think about the married couple's relationship within the story as being largely reduced to roles. You know, that she is producing children, and there's a moment where she despairs about the fact that she's become a kind of baby machine. And Stanley is very keen on bringing home, you know, putting the bread on the table and being the breadwinner, playing that kind of masculine role. And those two roles are explored in some detail, you know, but the fact that they are playing those roles is emphasised too. The children act out adult roles as children do. You know, they have a kind of tea party and they act out those roles. And so it emphasises that theme in the story in a kind of comic reversal of what the adults are doing. You know, the children are doing it too. And throughout the story, it seems to me that what we have is this idea of daily life, quotidian life, if you want to use a pompous phrase, as I have done there, presented as a series of adjustments in the presentation of the self. You know, that rather than just, if we go back to Polonius talking to Laertes, Polonius talking to Laertes in Hamlet, to thine own self be true. What Mansfield seems to be suggesting in Prelude and in her other stories and in her letters and her journals is impossible. You can't do that because there are lots of different selves that you present to the world depending on the circumstance that you're in. I mean, in doing so, she kind of anticipates quite a lot of sociological theory, which comes along later in the 60s and 70s. Which seems to confirm that, you know, this idea of role play and acting out the representation of the self, you know, seems to be something that we do. And, you know, Mansfield has anticipated that and put that into her stories. Okay, so moving on then. If we think about the Daughters of the Late Colonel, this story starts, it reminds me a bit of almost of the Ezra Pound in A Station of the Metro, in that you kind of need the title in order to understand the beginning. And like a lot of Catherine Mansfield's stories, this starts in medias res, in other words, in the middle of the thing. You know, we don't get a kind of long-winded introduction to tell us who these people are. We plunge into it. And so this is the opening. The week after was one of the busiest weeks of their lives. Even when they went to bed, it was only their bodies that lay down and rested. Their minds went on, thinking things out, talking things over, wondering, deciding, trying to remember where. And those ellipses are in the story, trying to remember where. The sentence isn't finished. Trying to remember where what, where something was, where something was going to happen. We don't know. And the story develops as an account of the immediate aftermath of the death of the late colonel and how his two daughters have to cope with this sudden vacuum in their lives. And it's very impressionistic. Even though it's a relatively short story, it's divided into 12 sections, each of which gives kind of a fleeting glimpse of some aspect of what's happening to the daughters after the death of their father. So again, you know, I think we have another characteristic of Catherine Mansfield there. That sense where we're not being led into a particular story, we're not being given an introduction, we're plunged into the action straight away. If we think about how the story then does develop, and you know, it's very difficult actually to say what happens in this story. They have various discussions. They think about who's going to get their father's watch, and you know, one or two other examples like that. And what are they going to do with their father's wardrobe? Those kinds of things, all very kind of trivial, you might think, but ones which consume the daughters in the days after their father's death. What it suggests, I think, is that their sense of self is lost as soon as their father disappears. And the title, "The Daughters of the Late Colonel," you know, perhaps gives you a nudge in that direction. You know, the title isn't Constantia and Josefina, for example. It's the Daughters of the Late Colonel, so they're defined by the relationship to their father. Compare Mrs. Dalloway. You know, she's being defined by her relationship to her husband in the title of that novel. Apparently, Mansfield wanted to call it, or did call it originally, the non-compounders, which is a very strange phrase. And it turns out that if you were a non-compounder at certain colleges in New Zealand, what that meant was that you were registered, that you were attending classes, but you weren't officially registered for that class. And I can remember a very long time ago, a kind of, almost like a Constantia and Josefina, actually, that when I was a student, there were always these two middle-aged women sitting in the front row, and they weren't students, but they attended every lecture and every class, and they made copious notes, and they smiled all the time, and they left at the end of the class, and that was that. You know, they weren't registered, so they were kind of non-compounders, I suppose. And of course, I suppose there's also a little gender reference there, aren't? You know, we have to remember that when she's writing this, you know, it's still not entirely normal for females to be students at university. You know, I look around this room now and see a majority of women. When Mansfield was writing, you know, there were certain universities, Cambridge comes to mind, which didn't allow women to graduate. You could attend, you could be a non-compounder, but you couldn't graduate. So that suggests something about their status, doesn't it? That they are kind of participating, but they're not fully in the game, as it were. So they're not full members of the society that they find themselves in, and that's because of the pressure of their father, who obviously kind of represents patriarchal society. And again, a bit like the end of The Garden Party, we finish on a moment of inarticulacy. They are unable to articulate what it is they're going to do next. They seem kind of lost. A couple of other things about this story. Stylistically, it is quite innovative, I think, because you've got these 12 short sections which alternate the point of view, and we move, therefore, in terms of the focalization, in terms of whose point of view we're actually inhabiting, that switches constantly according to which section we're in. There's also a sense of the symbolism that Mansfield often uses. So there are images of the wider world, you know, particularly images of the sea, the moon, you know, that sense of a broader landscape, a wider world out there, which they are not actually going to be able to inhabit, because they are just confined, as it were, to the sort of life that they've been used to so far. It's perhaps a bit fanciful to suggest they're like Estragon and Vladimir in Godot. If you know that play, Waiting for Godot by Beckett, I hate to spoil this for people who don't know the play. Godot never turns up. You know, the two characters, I know, I've spoiled it now. The two characters are waiting for Godot all the way through. And, they're constantly trying to persuade each other, oh, well, he's not coming here, let's go. But they never do. And it's a kind of metaphor for the stasis which affects modern life, you know, that kind of sense of inertia, I suppose. At the end of the play, one of them says to the other, you know, let's go. And the stage direction is, they do not move. And I was reminded of it at the end of The Daughters of the Late Colonel. They're talking to each other, and they can't. It's about the inarticulacy. They say, no, you. I was going to say, no, you say, go on, no, you. We do all that kind of stuff. And then a pause. Then Constantia said faintly, I can't say what I was going to say, Jug, because I've forgotten what it was that I was going to say. Josephine was silent for a moment. She stared at a big cloud where the sun had been. So, symbolic again, I think. Then she replied shortly, I've forgotten too. So at the end of it, these two daughters are as kind of marooned as they were at the beginning by the loss of their father, and that's expressed in that exchange at the end, or that kind of lack of exchange almost. So finally, I just want to say a few words about her first ball. If we're thinking about moments of being, or if we're thinking about that sense of some kind of intervention, it's a kind of rites of passage story, isn't it? This young girl's first encounter with a manifestation of the adult world, a ball. This is a kind of formal occasion, and this is the first time she's going to go. She's going to be dancing. She's going to be interacting with older people. It's very much a kind of symbol of growing up, isn't it? Typically, with Mansfield, she uses that free and direct discourse where we get into the mind of the character, we see things through her consciousness, and that allows her to present the impressions that she gains as she goes through into the ball and the kind of encounters that she has. It presents all those things this very fluid way as it occurs to the character. There's an interesting reference to, what goes on the other side of the door. And I'm not going to say too much about that now because I think that's something we can pick up in class. But symbolically, it seems to me that door has got to represent, a movement into adulthood. And is she prepared to go through that door? So we have this free and direct discourse where we don't have it occurred to her, she thought, any of that kind of stuff. We go straight into how she was thinking. It's very similar to, if you think about the opening of Mrs. Dalloway, what a plunge Mrs. Dalloway thinks. It's the same kind of feeling here. And so we move from the external description of what's happening. This is on the first page of her first ball. We go into her mind, where she's saying things like, oh dear, how hard it was to be indifferent like the others. She's trying to learn that kind of, that sense of, sort of slight detachment, the slight cynicism that you might acquire as an adult. She doesn't want to be all bubbly and enthusiastic because that's childish. She wants to be a bit cool, in every sense of the word, like the older girls that are there. Her brother is going to look after her, or at least that's his function. Oh, how marvellous to have a brother, is presented to her, unfiltered by the author. So it dramatises her naivety, I think, by presenting these thoughts as they occur to her through free and direct discourse. But ultimately, this story is a third-person one, and so typically in Mansfield and in Wolfe, you get this very fluid movement from the first-person perspective, if you like, of the free and direct discourse. This is what's going on in this person's mind. Movement from that to the third-person narration. And you have to be alert as a reader. You have to be on the ball to spot, you know, where those things have happened. You elide from one to the other very fluidly. And we can spot some of those moments when we look in more detail at the text. So, just summing up something about Mansfield's writing generally. Often concentrating on these, on women, very much about women, often vulnerable, often peripheral, you know, think of Mouse in Je ne parle pas français. That sense of alienation, that sense of a lack of identity is very much a modernist idea, very much something that's emphasised in a lot of modernist writings, and it's there in all of these stories, I think. And maybe, speculative, but you know, maybe relates to her life. A couple of other things that she's interested in, it seems to me, the social pressures of society on young women. You can see that in sort of extreme terms in Je ne parle pas français. You can see it in maybe less extreme terms in Her First Ball or Prelude. And the fact that she does deal sometimes quite frankly, sometimes quite overtly with sexual relationships is another thing that makes her modernist, I think. You know, she confronts the sexuality of her characters head on.